So this Mahamangala Sutta is in the Sutta Nipata, which we've used here before. It's one of the early collections of discourses from the Buddha. And this is Sutta Nipata from the second section, is the fourth sutta. And Mahamangala sort of means the highest blessings. Maha means high, highest or greatest. And then Mangala means blessings, or causes for happiness is another way of thinking of it. And one translation curiously calls it performances, which I never did quite figure out what that meant. So I'm not using that translation. And what these are is they are factors in our lives, in everyday life, that are causes for reflection of whether we have them in our life or not. So they're blessings, but they're also causes of happiness. So it's useful to look at what the Buddha recommended as having in your life as causes for happiness, and reflecting on whether that's really happening for you or not. And as we know in this practice, everything is a result of causes and conditions. And if some of these aren't present, well, what conditions might need to be met for them to be present? The they're sort of randomly placed. And Steve, in his talk, made a real useful grouping of them. So all of these 38 blessings break down into 5 groups. So they're external qualities, relationship qualities, internal qualities, spiritual practices, and spiritual attainments. It's not a very long sutta, so I'll just read it. It's unusual in the Sutta Nipata. Usually the Sutta Nipata doesn't have this frame around it, which indicates that it was written down later. Those frames are often added later. This one does have a frame, and it's unusual for the Sutta Nipata also in that the frame is this heavenly being that comes down and asks the Buddha a question. And that usually the Sutta Nipata is a little bit more down to earth and realistic than that. And the question is, many deities and men and women yearning after good have pondered on blessings. Pray tell me the greatest blessing. Buddha wasn't really into the yes-no answer, so he gave 38 of them. So he answers, not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise, and to honor those who are worthy of honor, this is the greatest blessing. To reside in a suitable location, to have done meritorious actions in the past, and to set oneself in the right course, this is the greatest blessing. To have much learning, to be skillful in handicraft, well trained in discipline, and to be of good speech, this is the greatest blessing. To support one's mother and father, to cherish wife and children, and to be engaged in peaceful occupation, this is the greatest blessing. To be generous in giving, to be righteous in conduct, to help one's relatives, and to be blameless in action, this is the greatest blessing. To loathe evil and abstain from it, to refrain from intoxicants, and to be steadfast in virtue, this is the greatest blessing. To be respectful, humble, contented and grateful, and to listen to the Dhamma on due occasions, this is the greatest blessing. To be patient and obedient, to associate with monks and to have religious discussions on due occasions, this is the greatest blessing. A mind unruffled by the vagaries of fortune, from sorrow freed, from defilements cleansed, from fear liberated, this is the greatest blessing. Those who thus ever abide, ever remain invincible, in happiness established, these are the greatest blessings. And that translation's from Narada Thera, It's access to insight. So when I when we put the recording up, I'll give Brian the link, and you can just link over to that translation. There are three others available at the same place. So we can hear in that list these external qualities to reside in a suitable location. You know, just think about living here in Sacramento, the access that we have to the Dharma, this new Dharma center that's going to be opening. We now reside in a location that has an urban Dharma center available for all, really, but founded by three different communities of people who are interested in meditation. That's a real gift. There are two flagship centers for the tradition that we practice in insight, Vipassana meditation, in the entire United States. One of them is in Barre, Massachusetts. Trust me, it's a long trip. I've been there by land and by air. It's a long trip either way. The other one is in Marin County, 2 hours from here. So in that way, we're in a suitable location. SBMG brings in guest speakers, senior teachers from three traditions. Many of them come from the Bay Area. Some of them are from around here. We're in a suitable location. We have access to the Saranaloka nuns up in Placerville. We're very fortunate in that. They used to live in San Francisco. They've moved here. We're in a suitable location. So we don't have control over that sort of thing. Who knows what causes and conditions led us all to be here. Some of us may not be very happy about being here. I just talked to a woman tonight who had just moved to this community and was very connected with some of the communities in the Bay Area. It was very sad to leave them, but is really happy to know what's happening in the Dharma here. So sometimes we don't really think about where we're living. It's kind of like the water that the fish are swimming in. But living in a suitable location is one of the causes for happiness. Now, some of us that are in the position of the sandwich generation, supporting both our parents and our children, may not always realize what a cause for happiness that is. There are challenges. And I personally, you know, I'm involved pretty closely now with working with my mom as she gradually, she's 86. So it is what it is. My dad's been dead for 13 years, so I don't have the opportunity to support my father anymore. So those of you that have both parents are fortunate. Those of you that are still taking care of children or have young children may not always seem like it, but that's a cause for happiness. And, you know, again, at 3 in the morning, when someone's running a fever, it might not seem like a blessing or a cause for happiness. But Buddha took the long view on these things. He wasn't necessarily always thinking about the happiness that's created in the moment that we wake up in the middle of the night from a cry in the other room. But in the long term, that's a good thing. And then I think many of these qualities, I think you probably recognize from our study of the precepts, you know, refraining from intoxicants, being steadfast in virtue, engaging in a peaceful occupation, right? Right livelihood. So I think we recognize those. This word obedient requires some explanation. I don't think many of us here in the West, especially in this tradition, are very enthused about doing something just because someone else told us to do it. Obedient in that sense. Turns out that word obedient, even though you'll see it in several translations, the actual meaning of that is ability to follow guidance. It means an openness of mind and the ability to follow guidance and instruction. So any of you that passed any grade in school, you have that. You have that ability. So that's a good thing. That's a cause for happiness. So just, you know, reflecting on these and realizing how fortunate we are. There is a form of gratitude that, I call it false gratitude, that takes the form of looking at someone else's misfortune and saying, I'm glad that's not me. So we need to be careful for that form of false gratitude. And particularly in this time when there is such injustice and such hateful speech and so many acts of violence, both verbal and physical violence, against people just because of who they are, that there's a temptation, if we're not part of one group or another that's being impacted by that violence, to feel like, oh, I'm fortunate because. But I think Buddhism gives us the understanding that that's not the other. Mm-hmm. That is part of us that's being subject to violence. And so this kind of reflection, yes, it does make us aware of how fortunate we are. Perhaps in today's terms, we might say the privilege that we have to be able to have access to these teachings and to be able to hear them. At the same time, knowing that it's not the intention or the ultimate goal of these teachings to cut us off from any of the pain and suffering of the world. It's really to connect us with that and to understand our connection with all of it. So just a word of caution there on gratitude and false gratitude. So, you know, whenever I just take even a moment to reflect on gratitude, I instantly think of my parents, you know, and how fortunate I was to have a loving family growing up. And then in this context, you know, I think about the teachers, you know, how fortunate I've been to have some of the teachers that I've had, starting with Dennis, you know, who wasn't able to be with us tonight, but who started this community and is still very much a force in its development, and who very much realized that a community like this cannot function if it's based on one person or one small group of people. So, you know, the intention as this community has moved forward is to involve more and more people in an ever-widening circle in its flourishing. So consider yourselves part of that intention. And spiritual friends, you know, everyone in this community. I mean, when we sometimes some of the insights that we have in this practice are a little bit hard to explain over the water cooler to casual acquaintances or even to coworkers who we might have been around for a long time but may not know our deeper selves. So it's always so helpful to have a community like this of people who, even if they may not understand your experience or at least have an open mind toward it and are accepting of some of the things that we share here. And then, you know, since I was out walking along the American River when I received Dennis's text, of course I instantly think of nature and my gratitude for the ability to have access to that in this community. I mean, we're so fortunate to have, you know, the two rivers, we have the mountains close by, we have the coast just a couple of hours away, and we have, you know, these heritage oak trees right in our midst. So in so many ways, we're very fortunate to have nature, which after all, it was where the Buddha practiced his entire life. You know, he did not have buildings. The monasteries that he was provided by his followers, including the one where this sutta was set, were groves of trees. So this one was supposedly set in Jetta's Grove. Anathapindika's Park, which is near Savatthi. You know, some of you have been there on pilgrimage. So there has always been that connection between nature and this practice. And so those of us that have access to that are very fortunate. The Buddha said that, you know, one of the causes for happiness that was mentioned here was to be generous in giving. And the Buddha said that reflecting on generous acts gives joy in anticipation of the giving, during the giving, and after the giving. And so, as Brian mentioned, for a couple of years now, the mentors have been receiving dana. And, you know, I had worked for many years with the practice of offering dana. But when we were offered the opportunity to receive dana, I realized that's not something any of us are instructed in. Even during Dennis's program, since at that time there was no practice for the mentors to receive the dana, that's not something I had ever worked with. So I actually set up an interview with Steve and said, you know, do you have any counsel for me to, you know, in this new practice of actually receiving dana from Sim? And typical Steve, what do you think his answer was? Watch your mind. So it has been a good practice over the last 8 years or so to watch the mind around this privilege, really, of receiving dana. So my wife Mary and I have a deal where when I go on retreat, we've agreed that the fee part of the retreat will pay out of our own resources. But to the extent that I can, I've tried to offer all of my dana on retreats, both teacher and staff dana, out of the dana that I receive here, both from the community on nights like this and from individuals that I'm working with. So I just thought it would be fun to tell you, just list for you, the dana that I've received that I've passed on. Because like Steve, I don't consider that dana mine. The dana that you offered to me, I consider to be an opportunity for me to support the growth of the Dharma in the West. So I just thought I'd give you a picture of where the dana that I've received has gone to. So this wouldn't include, you know, dana that Murray and I offer on a Thursday night out of our own resources or anything like that. This is just these things here that I'll list for you are just things that I've used the dana in the past 6 months to do. So I offer dana to Sam and to the Vipassana Metta Foundation, which is Steve and Kamala's organization. I offer monthly dana to them. I'm part of the Climate Sangha, which meets every month. I try to get to it every month. I didn't manage that in the last 6 months, but all of the dana that I offer them. Tony Bernhardt teaches a Dharma discussion group that, again, it's offered every month. I don't always make it. But all of the dana that I give to Tony comes from this. Past 6 months, I've been to Daylongs with Sandra here, Sandra Sigris, the other mentor that was in the first go-around of this program. Kamala Masters, if you remember, in February. The day-long with Diane that she did with Aya Santachita. And I did a day-long at Spirit Rock with James Barras and Bob Doppel on the climate. Working with the climate in a mindful way. I offered dana at SBMG, so I went and saw Musha Mikeda a while ago in April. That was really wonderful. Just beginning about a month ago, I was in a retreat at Spirit Rock, a 10-day with Steve Armstrong and Carol Wilson, who he's known, you know, since the 80s. And then Alexis Santos, who is a young guy that was a monk with Sayadaw Tejaniya in Burma and is back here. And actually, the last day of our retreat, he went through his graduation ceremony. He's now a fully acknowledged teacher in our tradition by a four-year training program that he did between IMS and Spirit Rock. And then Franz Muckel, who many of you may know, is a Qigong teacher. So they were the four teachers on this retreat. So again, I offered staff Donna to Spirit Rock and also teacher Donna to those four. Just in the past month, actually I found out about these just in the past month, because this book, The Manual of Insight, was published in May. Steve and Kamala have been working on this for 15 years.
Got published, I remember.
Finally got published by Wisdom. So this is the Orthodox Theravada Buddhist manual of the kind of practice that we do. The grandfather teacher was named Mahasi Sayadaw. He wrote this down, I think, in something like a month. It's pretty amazing. But it took 15 years to actually translate this. And then Upandita, who was a teacher in the Mahasi tradition that was Steve's teacher, recommended that they provide references to every quote in here from the Buddha, direct references to which sutta it came from. So you can imagine the scholarship it took to track all that down. I saw some early drafts of this that, frankly, were unreadable. They had so many footnotes and colors and comments and you know. But anyway, now that it's in this form, it's readable. It's dense, but it's readable. And so you'll be hearing a lot more about this book. I think Steve's going to do some retreats based on it. And
so where is it available? I mean, you can get it.
Wisdom Press.
Wisdom Press.
Yeah, but honestly, I mean, I got it from Barnes and Noble for a big discount.
What was the name?
It's called The Manual of Insight. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. He recommends Chapter 5, which is, you know, the actual practice. Some of it is kind of theoretical. Some of it's sort of tied into the Abhidhamma, some of it is actually, one reason this was never published before is that this contains in both Steve Armstrong, I don't know if you know him as a teacher, but before he became a Dharma teacher and a construction worker, he was an engineer. He did his degree in engineering. He talks about on his first retreat, he used to sit there and do long division of multiple digit numbers in his head. You know, he has that kind of mind. So what he's done in this book is he's created these maps of the teaching so that for those who are visually oriented... This gives you an idea of the complexity of the teaching. These are some of the charts that he's put together to help you follow what's going on with the text. Right. And among these is the progress of insight all the way to Nibbana. So, you know, I can't speak from personal experience. But I trust Steve when he says it's possible for lay practitioners in the West, living a householder's life, it's possible to taste freedom. So one reason this wasn't published before is that the tendency of our Western minds is to get a goal and want to get there. And if you try to do that with insight practice, you'll get in your own way and you'll never get there. It's the irony of it. So these are offered as a map, but, you know, if you're looking at the map when you're walking in the woods, chances are you're going to bump your head on a tree. You know, you need to be looking at the path, not at the map. This is just the map. The map is not the terrain, right? So be careful about reading about some of these exalted mental states and saying, oh, I want that, therefore I'm going to do this. That would be wrong application of this stuff. So with all the warnings, it's going to be an adventure going through that. And then this book just came out. Some of Sayadaw Utejaniya is a Burmese monk, lived as a householder for years, ran a store, but did his mindfulness practice, you know, started going off to the monastery when he was a little kid with his family. And some of his students, including Carol Wilson, Steve Armstrong, Andrea Fella, wanted this work to be more available. So as some of you know from the retreats that Steve and Kamala have done, they give his books out for free, right? Well, in the West, sometimes things that are free don't have much value in some people's minds. So what they did was actually published a commercially available book. Shambhala published it. So this just came out.
Shambhala,
yeah. So it's called When Awareness Becomes Natural, and it combines Sayadaw Utejaniya's teaching with some biographical information about how he grew up and how he developed in his practice and all that. So, fascinating book.
Thapa Rinpoche, when I was in LA, and they did a lot of Shambhala publications. Is that
yes, related? Shambhala actually is a Tibetan Buddhist term, mm-hmm. But they publish things in all three traditions, including Trungpa Rinpoche's work. And then, you know, I'm taking a class with Steve in the Abhidhamma right now. The Abhidhamma is a third basket of the Buddhist teachings. So the suttas is one, the Vinaya, the Code of Moral Conduct, is the second one, and the Abhidhamma is the third. It's not taught very much because it's extremely detailed, and again, people can get kind of hung up on how formal it is. But worth knowing, and once I finish the class, I'm in week 5 of a 6-week online course, I'm going to start teaching from that. There's some really beautiful insights there. And it's being offered as a practical thing. It's not being offered as theory. So you'll hear that coming out in the rest of the year. So the dana for that, I did the Ecosattva training, which is offered by the couple different Buddhist communities, on working with climate change and kind of in the context of Buddhism, and was able to offer some dana for that. And then just some random donations. I'd like to support the International Campaign for Tibet. I'd like to support Diane's nonprofit, the Buddhist Pathways Prison Project. And then there's a group that's promoting the teachings of Sayadaw Utejaniya in the West called the Wisdom Streams Foundation. And so I've offered some dana to them. So that just gives you an idea of what you might think of as just the flow, you know, just the pass-through of generosity that is available to us in this tradition when we have an open heart and an open mind, and we allow ourselves to feel the joy of generosity. Any questions about the sutta? I know I ran through that kind of fast. Or any anything people would like to share about their own practice of generosity or things that they're grateful for? Yeah?
Yeah, I had a question about the sutta. What do you think the teaching point is, and the significance was that the Buddha gave 32 answers about what the greatest blessing was instead of just identifying one thing?
Yeah. I think this sounds to me... I don't know if this starts off with saying he was, you know, in the presence of 500 monks or whatever. Yeah, it doesn't say. So this really sounds to me like an offering that was offered to lay people, to the fourfold sangha, the monks, the nuns, the laymen and women, because it sounds like he's trying to cover all the bases. And he's talking about very practical things. He's not just talking about things that monks would be doing, taking care of children, supporting your mother and father, having right livelihood and that sort of thing. So I think his point was that no matter what our circumstances are, these causes for happiness are available to us. Whether they're in external circumstances that we had nothing to do, or internal qualities like generosity that we're consciously cultivating with the practice, these are available to us. And as you know, he had this great gift for teaching in a way that was accessible to everyone. And so I think what he was doing was offering up a wide variety of things so that anyone in the audience could recognize, well, I may not have that, but yeah, I have this. Yes?
So why does it take a heavenly
effort? Again, I think that's probably just the authors. Later on, when when these are written down, because you know they're carried orally for hundreds of years, when these are written down, some other, there were like 18 schools of Theravada Buddhism, and the one that the parchments survived, because King Ashoka sent them off to Sri Lanka with his children, those survived. And so there was a tendency at times, and then there were other religions that were kind of competing for followers. There were the Jains at the time that were kind of rivals and so forth. So some of the people that wrote things down were in the business of kind of puffing up the Buddha, making him look supernatural, attributing things to him that would, in the context of the time, would make him seem like, oh, well, my teacher's better than yours because he can, you know, talk with heavenly beings, or because heavenly beings come and give him respect.
So. Because one of the things I thought about as you were reading the list was that those were such accessible things.
Yeah.
They're such common.
Yeah.
And they make you feel good just to hear the list.
They do. Yeah. Yeah, my thought is that he probably offered it at some point, you know, not necessarily all in one talk, but maybe offered them at various times. And then someone pulled it together, and then to put a frame around it, they just said, oh, heavenly messenger. Yeah, good point.
It's a joyful list.
It is. Yeah. Other thoughts, questions, reflections? According to the Abhidhamma, so when you have a pleasant exchange with someone, you have a nice conversation, how do you feel?
Pleasant.
That's a heavenly realm. In this lifetime, that's a heavenly realm. So, you know, we can get all formal and Buddhist about it and say, well, there's karma, and when you do wholesome acts, the result of that is pleasant feelings in the future. Okay? But the everyday reality of it is, when you have an open-hearted exchange with someone, in that moment, it puts you both in a pleasant place. That's a heavenly realm. That's a heavenly realm on this earth. So all of the realms that are depicted on that tanka over there, the wheel of life, are actually things that we can experience in this lifetime. They're depictions in fantastic form of mental states that feel a certain way. And actually, I'll be giving a talk. One of the things in the Abhidhamma course that Steve does is he takes that tanka right there and he goes through every element of it in the context of the Abhidhamma and explains it. It might take two sessions, but that's one of the ones I'll be giving in the future based on this Abhidhamma course. But the practical teaching that is important for us to understand is that when we do wholesome acts in that moment, that's a heavenly realm. That's a place with positive mental states associated with it, right? So that's all we really need to know.
Yeah. I don't know if I have the vocabulary to describe what I want to say, but it seems, what strikes me about that is kind of like very original with, you know, Suda, and it's not easily mapped on some sort of doctrine.
That's right.
You know, and so this makes me, maybe to someone like you or Steve, you can see the underlying place that the Buddha was coming from, but it seems to me he has such a much deeper understanding of. You can put labels in all these things, but he seems to come up with an entirely original way of describing how to be happy. He doesn't say you have to do the four.
The four of this and the five of that.
Yeah, it's just completely
that's right.
novel.
Yeah, so that is typical of the Sutta Nipata. The Sutta Nipata typically has these down-to-earth, pithy, they're short sentences, right? Pithy lists of things that don't map across to the formulaic, dogmatic lists that we see in the Nikayas, in the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya and so forth, Dhammavitara Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya.
So historically, are these believed to be delivered earlier
yes.
or written down earlier anyway?
Yes, they're believed to be collected earlier. Yeah. And so they typically like this. A few months ago, I gave a teaching on a version of dependent origination from here that only has 8 links. And they don't sound at all like the formulaic, 12 sort of, cyclic, et cetera, 3 lives and all that stuff. Not at all. So it's very typical. That's why I say the beginning of this is not very typical of the Sutta Nipata. But actually, the rest of it is. Just these very simple language, short sentences,
I guess I'm saying something obvious, but this is just, my experience is typical of someone who's completely has complete understanding of something. They can explain it in a completely original way.
Yeah.
And of course, this is why he's considered the Buddha.
That's right. That's right.
But still, it's shocking to hear it without any of the usual Buddhist doctrine.
That's right. Yeah. And some of the modern translators or explainers of the suttas offer that as a suggestion for whether a teaching is original or to the degree it's been massaged, you're going to get, the list with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 written on the line numbers on the left, That's probably not how he gave it. This is an oral tradition, There was a certain amount of structure to make it easy to remember. But when it's overly dogmatized and formulaic, it's probably been added on to later. Mm-hmm. Or massaged mm-hmm. in the writing down of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Thank you.
Are there holes, so a lot of people are really hung up on getting back to the original language. I think it I've used that word hung up now, so I can't really. But there are people at Oxford and Cambridge who want to know what this word really meant.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if there are whole scholars that now are mm-hmm. tracking what you're saying. Basically.
That's right, yeah. The probably the most prominent one that's reached down to the level of us daily practitioners is Bhikkhu Anālaya, who is a German monk. He did his PhD on the Satipatthana Sutta, so we've used his book in here to teach about the four foundations of mindfulness. And what he's done, his methodology is that he takes the Pali version of this canon. Pali is the ancient language that is similar to what the Buddha spoke, that it was written down in. He takes the Pali and he compares that to some versions that went over to Asia. So there's these Chinese, they're called agamas instead of nikayas, but the Chinese equivalents. And when you read his work, he'll say, well, this part's not in the Chinese, so it probably was added later. That's the methodology that he's using, So all he has to do is speak ancient Chinese, Tibetan, Pali, German, English, it takes a tremendous amount of scholarship, but that's his method of archaeology, is to compare the versions that got away, the ones that went over to East Asia before the other ones were sort of codified and everything, and certainly before they were translated into English, thousands of years before they were translated into English, and then kind of works backwards from there and then brings his translations, and he translates into English, to bring his translations based on those.
So,
Anālaya, A-N-A-L-A-Y-O. He was working and studying in Germany, but he has just become the scholar in residence at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, mm-hmm. which is a short walk from Insight Meditation Society in Berry, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So he has just taken on that mm-hmm. role from Andrew Olensky, if you've heard that name. He was the previous scholar in residence. So fascinating stuff, yeah. He has one follow-up to that, Satipatthana, the one that we used in here, that goes more into that archaeology. So, and you'll be hearing more from him now that he's in this country. Hand back there.
Yeah. Here is, I want to say, oh, gratitude, like, has always been big for me. And, you know, like, tonight, thanks for filling in on a, like, literally the last minute. But for me, like, I'm seeing gratitude, like, it's always been, like, a positive, like, something good happened, so I'm grateful.
Mm-hmm.
But lately, the last couple of years, it's been, like, something negative, what the mind wraps around is negative. But having grateful or gratitude for that, you know, I was thinking, like, last week I was with my mom who was having medical issues, but it brought our family, and we started having these really deep discussions that I was really grateful for. So it was something like the mind had perceived as negative,
mm-hmm.
but it was like a deep gratitude that mm-hmm. our family's finally talking and interacting as a family kind of a thing. And or when somebody gets sick, you know, the family comes together and kind of unites, and there's a lot of gratitude for that. Or so that's kind of what I've been working with on lately, is not everything that seems negative, like, doesn't have a piece of gratitude to it.
Yeah, that's right. That's sort of what I was trying to get at when I was talking about, you know, caring for parents and caring for children. But you put it much better, so thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, it's really just the whole pleasant and unpleasant thing is just our mind, right? It's just our judgment. It's all experience. I mean, like, you know, when we do our sitting meditation, it's all just experience coming by. We can judge it, or we can push it away, or we can want it, but it's all just experience. That's right view. Right view is recognizing that, you know, I mean, someone being sick is just another experience for them and us. So, yeah, sure, we can feel gratitude for the, you know, the dynamic, you know, one of the categories here was relationship qualities. You know, we can feel, you know, we may not like the sickness, but we can feel gratitude for the quality of the relationship that brings out.
In Diane's Year to Live group, I think it was a year or two ago, we did gratitude as a whole month practice, and that was huge. And in recovery 12-step stuff, it's always, that's one of the first things they talk about is gratitude. So it's a huge topic.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Yes?
General question. These are Tibetan tantras?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so how do they fit into the Vipassana teachings? Because I know Tibetan, they have a body of Vipassana teachings too. I'm not sure if they use the same name. But.
Yeah, they do. These, you know, the early Theravadins didn't have any symbols at all. If they had a symbol for the Buddha, it was like a footstep. That was it. So it's really just here in the West where we sort of mishmashed, you know, various traditions. And our particular community has these basically just as inspiration for our practice. So, you know, I mean, this one is the what the Mahayana would call the Sakyamuni Buddha, you know. The historical, what we would call the historical Buddha. And so, you know, that one's fairly obvious. Yeah, this one here, the White Tara, is really to recognize the feminine, the importance of the feminine in the way that we teach here in the West. The Manjushri on this wall is the sword that he's wielding is to cut through delusion. And that's certainly consistent with Vipassana practice. I mean, the whole purpose of Vipassana is to see clearly. And the way we do that is to come to a recognition that the way that we were seeing things was actually wrong view.
It's kind of central to the Vipassana teaching.
Yeah. I mean, we actually cut... When an insight arises, it's something that wouldn't have occurred to us in our regular rational thing. That's what categorizes it as insight. It arises spontaneously and intuitively. So that's that cutting through of delusion that You know, that's the reason we cultivate this practice, is to allow insight to arise. And then this Wheel of Life, that was a gift from Jeff Harden, who went, one of the other mentors that trained with Diane and me and now lives in Sedona, Arizona. And this was a gift from him when he went on pilgrimage to India in 2005. So he brought that back as a gift to our Sangha.
That would be like, that's your verbal language.
Yeah.
You could put that in a Christian church.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly they're beautiful. And, you know, never hurts to have beautiful things around. Especially things that have the depth of the layering of these. You know, I mean, part of what the Tibetans do that we don't do is that they'll, as a practice, will memorize that tanka. They'll memorize every element of it and hold it in their mind. The idea there is that you then are able to embody those practices in your own life. That's the theory behind it. We don't do that practice. We don't do a lot of visualization practice. But, you know, there's a whole bunch of layers of depth to each of these. So, you know, having something around that's beautiful is nice, but having something that's, you know, not only beautiful, but has a depth of teaching that's consistent with what we teach here is really nice. So, yeah, for those of you that have never been up here to look at this, you know, you might just think this is a nice little piece of cloth. What this is this was done by a member of our community who still is living but doesn't come anymore. She's elderly, named Noni Redmond. And it says, "May you be safe and protected, peaceful and happy, healthy and strong, free from suffering." And it's done in a very beautiful, remember the part about handicrafts? Is one of the things that the Buddha recommended as a cause for happiness. She studied with a Japanese teacher this map. It's sort of a weave. It's actually a weaving.
It's the weave they make their sashes.
That the priests wear and things?
Right. And,
yeah.
And the women.
You know, and the women too? Yeah. So this is actually woven. And so come up and look at it sometimes. So, you know, if you look at how thick this is and then you look at this, there's that many threads. That gives you an idea of the tightness of the weave. So just come up and look at it, and it's reversed. It comes all the way through. It's an amazing piece of work. So, you know, we keep things around like this, not just because they're beautiful and not just because they represent the generosity of the person that donated them, but because they have something real to them that is consistent with the way we teach.
Just as an aside, the stained glass windows in cathedrals were used as teaching tools, and if you go to Chartres, there's this wonderful English scholar who gives no two lectures the same, and he talks twice a day, but goes through the stained glass windows They also use that as a visual teaching tool because, of course, the people they were teaching weren't literate. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love about the talk is I always think of that one as one of my bad days because of the colors and all that. But when you go and you take a look at them, or the slicing through those, even though Vipassana doesn't ask us to do that, it nonetheless can speak to you at a certain point. I think
they're
wonderful teaching.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. So in the spirit of Noni's weaving, why don't we close with thoughts of metta, one of the positive states that we cultivate in this practice is this boundless quality of friendliness that we extend to all beings. So even though many of us are brought to this practice out of the depths of our suffering, and even though we make progress on the path by recognizing the gross and subtle forms of our unskillful mind states and behaviors and language, still it's important to both cultivate the positive qualities and to recognize them when they've arisen, and to feel gratitude for them. So in this world that is in such need of kindness, friendliness, compassion, joy, an impartial but engaged caring. May we dedicate whatever positive energies we've generated tonight by listening to the Dharma and discussing the Dharma to lessening and eventually eliminating the suffering in our lives and in the lives of all beings.